Hello, everyone. Welcome to show number 4. I'm your host, Alan Campbell, and this is Unjabbed Citizen. Scrolling through social media this morning over my coffee, two things stood out. First, Auckland's Middlemore Hospital. 1 year to prepare for the oncoming onslaught of hospitalisations due to COVID-19, especially in those unvaccinated people. A massive increase in ICU beds, and by massive, I mean one. That's right. We have added one ICU bed to the country's largest hospital. On the positive side, a reminder that if you don't take the vaccine, you're 100% safe from adverse effects and 99.8% safe from the virus itself. And then there is this gem.
Yeah, so it's 2015 that I gave the TED Talk and wrote a number of papers titled "We're Not Ready for the Next Pandemic." And sadly, that was a better forecast of what would happen than anyone would have wished for. You know, the economic damage, the deaths, it's been completely horrific. And I would expect that will lead the R&D budgets to be focused on things we didn't have today. You know, we didn't have vaccines that block transmission. We got vaccines that help you with your health, but they only slightly reduce the transmissions. We need a new way of doing the vaccines.
So what? Vaccines that only slightly reduce transmission, but vaccine passports all over the world to stop transmission? Anyone else confused? I was about to hit submit on the podcast and go and enjoy my day when this came through. A post from Ian Wishart, which I just had to share. He says, "Some of my media colleagues don't like the criticism, but again, I have to call them out for leaving key facts out of COVID stories. Later this morning, news broke of a fully vaccinated person who tested positive in Christchurch after returning from a visit to Auckland. Initially, media reported the case was fully vaccinated. All good. But by the 6 p.m. news, that detail was missing from stories. And curiously, missing from the Ministry of Health media release. In fact, tonight you'll be hard-pressed to find any current news stories discussing the vax status. Why is it relevant? Because the patient is a mother of 3 children under the age of 11. It is highly likely she is fully vaxxed less than 3 months ago. This scenario of vaccines wearing off much quicker than the assumed six months, is becoming all too common. I pinged staff last week for telling the story of a fully vaxxed Auckland man catching COVID, but failing to mention when he had been fully vaxxed, just 6 weeks earlier. A thunderstorm always begins with a few spits of rain, and then suddenly there's a deluge. I think a COVID thunderstorm is coming, and many who have been vaxxed are going to get a surprise. The media are constantly running talking points from immunologists and science communicators, assuring the public that they will get at least 6 months protection from the vaccine, and really minimise the risk of passing it on to others. Clearly the communications are not up to speed with the latest studies. Even the CDC has admitted this week that the vaccines are not preventing spread of the virus as expected and are not good enough to end the pandemic. And yet the government, the opposition, business leaders, talkback hosts and the news media are marching in lockstep to promote vaccine passports as the key to freedom. Was it really a pathway from the frying pan into the fire? 1.6 million Aucklanders, with Delta silently infesting them, are about to get their vax passports and be unleashed on all corners of the country, unaware that the vaccines are not going to prevent them catching COVID and spreading it. Clearly as early as 6 weeks after the jab. National is right. We are going to have a COVID Christmas, after all. If there was ever a time for the media to be asking hard questions about the unexpectedly short duration of protection from the vaccine, that time is now. I really do feel like a spectator in the crowd as the naked emperor rides past the cheers from a crowd who have been let down by news media, too timid or uninformed to investigate vaccine efficacy. Don't get me wrong, we can't lock down forever, and as I've said before, the vax should be able to avoid the worst outcomes personally, albeit despite my calculations that most of recent New Zealand Delta deaths have actually been double jabbed. But ironically, it's the vaccinated who are about to see the biggest explosion of COVID that New Zealand has seen yet. And the unvaxxed are going to cop it. Sure, most are unvaxxed by choice. but that just illustrates how surreal this crisis has become. The bitter irony is that we have just divided the team of 5 million in the name of promoting a vax passport system that even Blind Freddy can see is going to be a Christmas super spreading disaster. And when school resumes in the new year, everyone's children will become fuel, and it's game on. I hope I'm wrong, but based on the UK, Israel, and USA, I'm not holding my breath. The vax will help protect you from acute COVID, but it won't prevent you passing it on. And when you hug grandma at the beach, if anyone reading this seriously believes their vax passport is proof of immunity, I've got last week's winning lotto ticket for sale. Okay, so it's pretty clear that things are going from bad to worse here in New Zealand, and in fact, in most places around the world. When New Zealand first went into lockdown, I said to a mate of mine, "Welcome to the police state." He laughed and dismissed my fears. Now, after almost 2 years of being told to wear a face covering, being told to stay at home on and off for long periods of time, after thousands of businesses have been shut down, after many Kiwis have been faced with being forced to undergo a medical procedure or lose their livelihoods, and after all the non-COVID-related, undemocratic legislation that has been passed, he still can't see it. He can't see the tyranny of government interfering in doctor-patient relationships and removing medical licenses where doctors prescribe off-label drugs for a disease where there is no official treatment. Like most, he is transactional. His rational mind looks at a single issue and rationalises it as being either suitable or not for the apparent issue at hand, or not affecting him, so it doesn't matter. Like most, he lacks the ability to see the larger picture, to see that freedoms lost, no matter how small, or for whom, are freedoms that we will never again enjoy. He can't see the link between the pandemic and the increasing talk of climate change health issues, the link between the vaccine passport, digital currency, and the projects already looking at how individuals can be allocated carbon credits. He can't see a day when his passport stops him from buying petrol because he's used up his monthly allocation, or stops him from buying beer because he's used up his carbon miles. He trusts the science, but he can't see the flaws in the trials of the vaccines, like the fact that there is no longer a control group. He dismisses the claims of adverse reactions as fake or overstated, or too small a number to worry about. That, for me, is the saddest part. Throughout this journey, research institutes, governments, and pharmaceutical companies have taken us on. Real people have been harmed. Yes, many have suffered from the virus, though not as many as they would have us believe. But many thousands have suffered from those jabs. Scroll through page after page of stories of real people, many of them young, many that were in the prime of their life. Read their stories, listen to their voices, hear their anguish, and rationalise that for me. A week ago, I had a discussion with him and another mate. We talked about many things and followed up that with an email exchange, which I'll talk about following this week's guest interview. The German Democratic Republic. Why do so many totalitarian states use the word democratic in their title? Anyway, the German Democratic Republic collapsed in a very public way on November 9, 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell. My next guest, Mario, grew up in East Germany during that period. He notes that today, New Zealand is worse. Yes, you heard that correctly. New Zealand today is worse than the communist state of East Germany, where he grew up. Afternoon.
Hello.
How are you going?
Afternoon.
Sorry for having to push this back.
No worries. I had some changes coming up and completely forgot about our meeting this afternoon. I'm actually down in Taupo.
Oh, okay.
I said Zoom meeting would be, mostly committed.
Yeah. So you managed to escape Auckland?
Yes, I did. The client down in Taupo, they organized an exemption. I couldn't get one for construction, but they organized on a freight for a significant infrastructure project, and they just called it like that, and then they get an exemption to get me through the borders.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate it. Now, this is a bit of a off-the-cuff conversation because I really don't know much about you at all.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do and family and that type of thing to start with?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Mario, obviously, and 52 years old, and I came with my family in 2007 from Germany to New Zealand because we had to change a little bit. It was a bit, I wouldn't say boring, but I didn't have much free time in Germany. It was only work, work, work. Prices, everything went up, so we had to make some decisions, and then we decided to sell the house and move away. And yeah, New Zealand was our destination. We sent everything off, went to New Zealand, started searching for jobs, and then yeah, started a completely new life.
Why did you choose New Zealand?
It was actually the only country on the world map left we would have gone to, because we started in Europe. Either we wouldn't have earned any more money, so it was no point to go away and move somewhere else in Europe. Then America or United States and Canada was really hard to get into with the immigration rules and work permits and that stuff. Then South Africa wasn't really an option because of some issues with drug trafficking and all that stuff. And Africa, I don't know, not really much to work in Africa, at least was what we thought back then. So, and last was Asia. And in Germany, I wasn't really a big fan of the Asian culture. And then was only Australia and New Zealand left on the map. And since we hate venomous snakes and spiders, so we landed in New Zealand.
Oh, fantastic. It's good to have you here.
So
you grew up in East Germany, is that correct?
Yes, I was born in 69 in East Germany, grew up, went to school, was part of the youth organizations all the way through to school. And pretty much grew up on the socialist dictatorship, but didn't personally Dad noticed it because I didn't know anything different. So it was only up to the stage when we found out that we can't really travel, we can't really leave the country apart from in the East European countries. And we can't go visit our family. We still had aunties and uncles and cousins on the western part of Germany. Or we received maybe now and then for Christmas a parcel with some nice chocolates in or some clothing. And then at some stage we found it needs to change. And then people started revolting against that whole thing because we're in a similar situation we are right now. And then people started going on the streets, and then we joined them. And then we went for how many months on the streets in Leipzig.
Right.
And then at some stage, I think it was back then Gorbachev. He was consulting with back then president of the States, and they pretty much agreed that it's time to open the borders, take down that wall, and then get one country back.
Right. You mentioned sort of parallels to today. How do you compare today to back then when you look back? And
I would say it's even worse than what I experienced back in East Germany.
Oh, wow.
Because we at least could travel around the country. We even could go to holiday where we want to. We didn't have to use QR codes or notify where we went. We didn't have to do tests. We didn't have to take vaccinations. We didn't want to. It was only one occasion I remember when I came to work. And it was just before the wall pretty much came down, a year or so before. Then when I came to work, then they forced us to take a flu vaccination. But it was either earning money or take the vaccination. So back then it was only one shot. We took it and forgot about it.
Right.
But what they do now in New Zealand is just, it's horrible. It's not even nightmares, just I don't know, it's out of this world, it's beyond belief.
Yeah, really interesting to talk to you about that. When the virus first started coming out of Wuhan, what were your sort of initial thoughts around it?
I mean,
when you first heard about COVID,
when we heard first when COVID pretty much turned up, then we thought it might be really a threat and it might be a virus. And then we follow pretty much everything. The first 4 weeks of level 4 lockdown were actually enjoyable time because it was the longest time I've ever had off work my whole life. So, and us living on a lifestyle block in out in Puhoi, I enjoyed the time. I could spend for bushwalks, weather was nice. We had enough food and we changed diet just half a year before. So we had pretty much enough food stored up. So we didn't even need to go out much and go grocery shopping. So we enjoyed the time. But then after the level 4, then we found it's hard to get to site because even level 3 was difficult. And then we started talking to relatives and friends back in Germany, and they, at least it looked like they were more advanced with that whole COVID story. And they already went on and found out that it's not just about a virus, and the virus is actually not as deadly and contagious as propagated. And then we started digging into it and collected all information, talked to friends in New Zealand, and then found more and more people pretty much with a similar opinions that it's, at some stage we were convinced that it's not about a virus and the virus itself. It's not as deadly because they accounted every single death as a COVID death.
Yep. Including those that have been shot.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's, we started to be really, really suspicious. And then our son was one, when they mentioned the vaccine they developed, then our son was the first one putting his hand up. And he said, oh, as soon as that comes, then I want to protect myself and take it. And then said, hey, if they just started with the vaccine, I would be cautious because you don't know what they develop. Because given all the vaccines which existed over the years, or we took over the years, like for measles or tetanus, all that stuff that's been tested over decades and then approved and been more or less safe and did more good than bad. But that one pretty much developed in a few months. It's there's something wrong with it. And I don't buy into that they've been working on a COVID vaccine already for 10 years, like my former GP tried to explain to me. I didn't buy into that because of the combination with the mRNA and all the tests being done. I think the test objects died in a matter of 36 months. And then, we started to realize it's not all about just that.
Yeah. So you're not against vaccines per se, it's just this particular one?
Yeah, it's just that particular one. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I wouldn't call myself an anti-vaxxer. I'm just declining the current COVID jab.
Right.
Because I'm fully vaxxed on polio and measles and I don't know how they're all called. I've got all the full vaccinations all year. And we vaccinated our kids as well. So our kids are fully vaccinated with all these children or child vaccinations you usually get.
Right. And it was just purely your research that led you to that decision?
Research and talking to like-minded people, like friends. They were cautious. And we had a friend who was actually an anti-vaxxer, and he dug out already more information than we had. And then we had chats with him, and then we actually started to believe him because he was already looking into all the common vaccinations before. And then we collected many informations from different sources.
Right. Okay. So what would you say to the people that are taking the vaccine and are saying, just take it so that we can all be free?
I would say you're really stupid because we had that situation when our son, we didn't have much knowledge. And when he came up and was available in New Zealand earlier this year, he went in, got the two jabs, and you didn't hear much about adverse reactions, not even from overseas. But then as more of that developed, everybody we met and said, oh, I want to take that shot, I want to make a booking. Then we said, oh, I personally wouldn't recommend it. I personally wouldn't take it because of the risk, because you don't know what you're actually getting. And then the biggest battle was with our daughter, and she only went last week and got her first dose, even though she knew that we really, really hard against it. And we know the risks. We even have friends who suffered. We had one friend, we suspect that he died after the second shot because he had internal bleeding. He was suffering on throat cancer, and he was more or less stable until they started putting the chaps into him. And then he just had internal bleeding and just died. I mean, it's definitely not proven, but we suspect that it's something to do with the chap. And I found out last week that the Casey Hutchinson is actually a partner of my former apprentice. And even though many, many people said, oh, she's just faking, she's faking, I know my apprentice, and which is her partner. And he's definitely not faking anything. I haven't seen him speechless as I could see him on in some of the videos. And I contacted him directly, and he said it's for real. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how he can help. And it's 100% real what you can see in those videos. And I really don't understand the people saying, oh, she's just faking. She just wants to have attention and all that crap. And that's a bit sad. And when you see your own daughter going to get the chap, just because she wants to teach in a gym or be staying in the local fire brigade, and just for those reasons, not really for health medical reasons, that's a bit sad. And yeah, it was a bit hard on the family too.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible, isn't it? I know when the first report started coming out, and I watched some videos very, very early on, and people said they were faking it back then, and I don't quite know why people think there are literally thousands of people that have had adverse effects, and you know they can't all be faking it. It's just
no, I don't think so. And it's not just what we live, what we have for here in New Zealand. It's also a friend of us back in Germany, and what she's pretty much collecting all the information. She's intensely fighting against that whole COVID scenery, and she said there's some rest homes in Germany that's on a daily basis. You can hear that's 4, 5, 6 people dying in the rest homes. It's not just the residents of the rest homes. It's the nurses in the rest homes as well, who took the double chap and just started after 5, 6, 7, 8 months and just started dying. Well, that's a bit nothing to do with saving humanity and taking their chap. It's more like getting rid of it.
Yeah, what's your thoughts on, I guess, the reasons why? I mean, do you think it's purely about money or something even worse than that?
No, it's more sinister than money. It's not just about money. It's I would say it's definitely to do. I mean, Bill Gates is heavily involved in everything, and even though he's denying it, but he was publicly propagating to reduce the human population. And that's already for years and years and years. And I know that he had experiments done with vaccinations back in India. A few years back, he had experiments with vaccinations pretty much to sterilize children in Africa. And since he is heavily involved in that, then I more believe that it's more like a genocide than a chap against the virus. And as you can see, I mean, if the virus would be so contagious, we wouldn't have just 100 or 150 cases in Auckland. We would have thousands of cases like everywhere else. And then it doesn't add up to me.
No, the bit that strikes me the most is the almost linear correlation between the increase in COVID jabs and the increase in COVID cases.
Yeah.
You're in construction. How do you think not getting vaccinated is going to impact you? And has it already had an impact?
I think I'm one of the lucky ones because we import our building products or most of it from Germany. We build houses using clay blocks. We also get our plaster imported. We get the windows imported. So we pretty much get almost everything apart from concrete and steel from overseas. And it's only three people in the country with the knowledge about that building system. And because it's healthier living, warmer living, energy efficient living, then the demand is growing. And then since we only have three people in the country available, then our clients don't really care. Nobody asked me so far. And if they must say, if you don't like it, then try to get somebody else. And I know the other two guys, so they're pretty much on the same page. So I know they wouldn't get anybody to build their houses.
Fantastic. So you own the business, do you?
Yes.
What's the name of the business?
Index Construction Limited.
Okay. Index Construction. Excellent. Yep. Sounds great. And it's a growing business, obviously, going well?
So far, we pretty much used the subcontractors, and it was only a family business. And my son and myself, we built the houses so far. But since I have contracts for three houses already signed for next year, then I definitely need to get some people on board. Okay. And employ some people. But I will definitely try my best to get unvaccinated people, because that's the one losing their jobs. And I feel safer around the unvaccinated than the vaccinated.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a bit strange. And my wife experienced that every time she's closer to, especially freshly vaccinated. We could see it with our daughter since last week, that my wife has a blocked nose and a rough throat.
Yeah.
So you can definitely feel there's something is going on. Something is not really right, because it's not really season for having a cold or something.
Yep. No. So did your wife take a similar journey as you? You sort of came to the conclusion together, or was it?
Yes, because yep. We grew up together. We were neighbors already back in East Germany, and we got engaged pretty soon, had kids, and we celebrate our 30th wedding anniversary this year, the day before Christmas.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. So,
and she is pretty much the same. And she couldn't wait to get into the Auckland domain to be part of the demonstrations right. And the march. Because she was the first one back in East Germany being on the streets, even before me.
Okay. Yeah, it must be kind of surreal thinking back to that time and then having to do similar stuff again.
It's like a déjà vu. We thought we left that time behind us, and then just to relive everything. And even with a level up, it's just some mornings we just look at ourselves and say, is that for real, or did we just dream it?
Yeah. I see Austria is starting to impose lockdowns just for vaccinated people. I'm not sure what Germany's doing. Do you have any?
I think it was proposed in Bavaria as well.
Right. Okay. And
Germany already started to pretty much close supermarkets for unvaccinated. So as long as you don't have the jab, you can't get access to supermarkets, not even with a negative test.
Jeez.
So if you're not vaccinated, if you don't have your vaccination cards, then you're not getting access.
Wow. It's horrendous, isn't it?
And I think it's the way New Zealand is going too. When you see what Foodstuff and Countdown proposing, then it's just a matter of time. So if you don't stop going on the streets and fight it, then that will going to happen in New Zealand too.
Yeah, I was going to ask that sort of, where do you think it ends in New Zealand?
I hope that we can stop it before the worst is coming. When you can see, I was at the Auckland Domain on the first picnic on the 2nd of October, and we were about 3,000-4,000 people. Then on the second meeting, it was already up to probably about 6,000 or 7,000 people. And then when that march happened, then it was somewhere between 12,000 and 15,000.
Yep.
So you could see every single or every fortnight, the amount of people doubled, and it wasn't just unvaccinated. It was vaccinated, double-jabbed people there as well, because they didn't like all the measures. They didn't like the mandates and whatever comes with it. So they're on the streets too, and it's not just an anti-vax protest. It's protest against the taking away our freedoms.
Yeah, I guess the good news the numbers are growing quite rapidly, which is great. Yeah. So hopefully we'll be able to make a difference. Does your wife work as well? Is she?
She is pretty much a stay-at-home mum since she had thyroid cancer in 2000.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, we just finished building our house back in Germany, our first one, and moved in. And 3 months later, she had a sore throat, went to the doctors, and he sent her to get an X-ray. And then X-ray came back with some foreign objects, if you want to call it like that. And then she could either leave it in or get surgery. And she opted for surgery, went to local hospital. And then they didn't even close up the throat properly. They just pretty much stapled it and sent her off to Munich in a specialist clinic. And she was lucky. Usually she would have had to wait for 6 months to get a spot for proper surgery. And then the surgeon in our local hospital was good friends with the professor on the at the clinic in Munich. So she went pretty much under the knife the next morning. And they removed as much as they could, including quite a few lymph nodes. And then she had radiotherapy in Munich with some radioactive stuff. And then, she was declared after 5 years that she's cancer-free, but she couldn't go back to work. She tried for just half days, but even that didn't work out. She was just exhausted after a couple of hours. And then, we said, as long as I have enough or my income is enough to pay rent, to pay all the bills, then she doesn't need to go to work. And we managed to keep that until today.
Yeah, that's great. That's minutes. Been a heck of a journey for both of you, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, my wife was back then, she was 21 and then diagnosed with cancer. It's
wow. Yeah. So, I mean, there's been a few doctors and even some in New Zealand that have said they either wouldn't treat or unvaccinated people would be at the bottom of the queue for treatment. What would you say to doctors like that?
They pretty much put up an oath to actually help people. So I don't really get it why they just follow what they've been told by the government, and they should actually give up their license. It's not a doctor, in my opinion, anymore. If you treat people like that, and as media is floating around, if they are true or not, I don't know. But people are being treated in garages or in the pretty much through the back doors and all that stuff. So if this is something, just some of them true, then it's just disgusting. It's I don't know. The only what I'm hoping is if they would come, what's suggested to follow Singapore, that only the vaccinated will get. Pretty much their treatments paid by taxpayer money and everybody else has to pay privately, then our health insurance will kick in. That's at least hope in that regard, because we signed up with health insurance already 10 years ago. And the insurer was saying there's no issues with us being unvaccinated or unchapped. So they will definitely stick to it. They've picked up as more. They're more concerned if you go and get double checked because of the adverse reactions. Right. And they may lose payments if something sinister or something really the worst happen.
Yeah. Okay. It's good to know that your health insurance stays in place. I know there's a few life insurance companies, particularly in America, that aren't covering people that are vaccinated. So it's going to be an interesting time. Yeah. So is there anything else I should have asked you? Is there anything else that you want to tell me?
We just currently explore in regards to common law. Then we try to get together with like-minded people and build a community next door, because we have larger pieces of land. One of that was up for sale earlier this year, and already advertised on Facebook if like-minded people would like to build up a community and then grow our own veggies, grow our own meat, and help each other, and then maybe even grow the whole communities.
Okay.
We're less reliant on supermarkets or on governments.
Right. So is that like a community garden type approach?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, we want to try to buy the land, which was for sale earlier this year, and then subdivide and build family homes on it. Okay. And we can pretty much supply the houses for way less than what you would pay in housing companies. Because if everybody can bring in their time, then we can build the houses together. And right. We can much minimize the labor cost.
Okay.
So they only pretty much pay for materials, and then we build the houses together.
That's a fantastic idea. So did you say you've already brought the land, or you're...
No, we have in our street, one of the neighbors, she tried to sell but couldn't sell because she didn't find the people paying the money she's asking for, and she also didn't find a new place to stay or a new place to buy. And we certainly could help her to find a new place. And if we get five people together, five families, and everybody jumps on board, and I think we had about $500,000. What it would cost to buy the land and build a three-bedroom family home.
Okay.
And that's compared to what you buy in Millwater or in the area in Silverdale. It's almost half of that.
Right.
So
yeah.
It should be affordable for families.
Yeah, it'd be a lot less than half for some of those properties around there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's what we're currently working on.
Okay. Fantastic. So how much land is that? What's the...
I think about 25
acre. Oh, okay, right.
So we can subdivide. You can have five blocks of 5 acre because that's the smallest we can subdivide in the area we live in.
Right, yeah.
And then we give us five families, and then we can potentially add another five minor dwellings,
yep.
Which would give space for another five couples if they want to join in.
What a great idea. And then all working together in the garden. And
definitely do pretty much do all the gardening together. And then you have some cattle running around, some sheep, and help each other and see if we can find even different traits. And then potentially grow the community and then buy another piece of land around the corner.
Okay.
And then carry on and then just build our own village.
Fantastic. See, it's great to see you taking practical action.
Oh yeah, I mean we can't just, we still go on the streets and fight what's currently happening, but we also want to be prepared for whatever might come if we don't win our battle.
Yeah, well, it's certainly difficult to know what's going to happen. Is the supply chain shortages impacting your business at all?
I had to put up the prices for our houses slightly because the sea freight from Germany to New Zealand. Pretty much quadrupled since last year. So I pay four times off for the containers compared to what I paid last year.
Wow.
But it's still, if I compare the prices to the housing companies because of the timber shortage, we're still less expensive than the housing companies. They already reached above $3,000 square meter, and we're still just under.
Okay. So tell me about the houses that you build.
We use fired clay blocks, and they're pretty much manufactured and designed. We use a model of blocks which is designed for earthquake prone countries. They're pretty much developed for Greece and Turkey, but they're also suitable for New Zealand. And we've done some computer simulated testing, or our structural engineer did, together with a professor from the Auckland University. And we have capacity in the event of an earthquake of about 400% compared to a timber frame house.
Wow, that's impressive.
So we figured, because it goes up exponentially, the forces, then we figured that when all the timber frame houses already collapse, then we still have houses you can live in. So you have cracks, of course, and you will have movement, but it's still inhabitable.
Yeah, still a shelter.
Yeah, and if you compare the prices, we supplied for just under 3,000, and the housing company has already put up the prices to just above. And we don't rely on the timber, because we can even put a flat roof and membrane on top, so we don't even need any timber frames or any timber for anything in the build.
Right. Wow.
And it's nice and cool in summer, without air conditioning is, yeah, it stays warm. Whatever source of heating you use, it's still warm in the mornings. It's no crying windows because we use triple glazing. And it's with a lime rendered inside. It's a nice leather protection outside. So it's a different kind of living.
Fantastic. Sounds awesome. I'm going to have a closer look at it.
Oh, yeah, just when I'm back in Auckland and you're around, just pop in for coffee and I can show you.
Yeah,
can feel it. You can definitely, especially if it's hot outside, you can definitely feel it. It's nice and cool inside.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Thank you very much. Okay, look, I've taken up, I know you're busy and you're on the road. Is there anything else that you'd like to say before I let you go?
Just to people that they shouldn't be stupid to take the jab just because they want to try to keep their jobs or just to follow the mandates. It's just if they do it just for medical reasons, if they think it will save them from the virus, then go for it. But definitely not for just to try to keep your job. There's definitely jobs out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which you can get without having the jab.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Look, thank you very much for joining me. I really do appreciate it. And I certainly hope that we get to catch up again when you get back into Auckland. It'll be fantastic.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you very much. Cheers. Sure,
thank you.
Bye. I enjoyed meeting Mario immensely. Him and his wife have a hell of a story. Growing up in a socialist country. Coping with cancer. Moving to the other side of the world. And finding yourself back in a socialist country. Despite all that, he continues to work and work hard. And he's taking practical steps to build a community that can survive what is coming. Okay, so a week or so ago, I had a wide-ranging discussion with a couple of mates. We talked about many things, including vaccine mandates, ivermectin, and the numbers of jabbed people ending up in hospital versus those that are unjabbed. A couple of days later, I emailed an article from the Indian Express. The article was headlined, Uttar Pradesh Government Says Early Use of Ivermectin Helped to Keep Positivity and Deaths Low. The subject line I used was, Ivermectin Debunked? I did this for a specific reason. Throughout the course of the discussion, there have been numerous claims that ivermectin as a treatment for COVID had been debunked. The response I got was in a word, yes, with some commentary and links to different articles and studies. To be fair, the comments were noted as being related to the studies rather than the actual efficacy, but the inference was pretty clear. So let's set the scene. First, from the Weekly Blitz. In June, 5 weeks after health officials in Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state, launched an aggressive program to fight COVID and the Delta variant, new cases dropped by a staggering 97.1%. The World Health Organization praised the overwhelming success of the program, but would not identify the medicines used and the kits provided to residents. On August 25, the Indian media finally picked up the discrepancy between Uttar Pradesh's massive success and the failure of other states, such as Kerala. Although Uttar Pradesh was only 5% vaccinated to Kerala's 20%, Uttar Pradesh had just 22 new COVID cases on August 25, while Kerala was overwhelmed with 31,445 that day. News 18 reported, let's look at the contrasting picture. Kerala, with its 35 million, on August 25 reported 31,445 new cases, the bulk of the total cases reported in the country. Uttar Pradesh, the biggest state, with a population of 240 million, meanwhile reported just 22 cases in the same period. So what was in the kit? Each home kit contained the following: paracetamol, vitamin C, multivitamin, zinc, vitamin D3, ivermectin, doxycycline, and other non-medication components, which included masks, sanitizer, gloves, and alcohol wipes. In response to my email, I was sent back a number of links. 1. Fact checked by Health Feedback. says the claim is unsupported. Note, unsupported, not debunked. They said, many other factors including immunity from previous infection, vaccination and lockdowns, likely helped reduce the number of cases. Remembering that at the time, only 5% were vaccinated. There was a review of 14 previous studies, in which the authors concluded, we are uncertain whether ivermectin reduces or increases mortality compared to no treatment. Again, uncertain. It was also noted in the email that doxycycline appeared to be used with ivermectin in some cases, and that given that this is used to treat respiratory infections, that may have had a greater impact than ivermectin. One of the points always raised about ivermectin is that it's an antiparasitic, not an antiviral. It's a fair call. However, a quote from the study in the American Journal of Therapeutics, sourced from the National Center for Biotechnology Information, ivermectin is a well-known medicine that is approved as an antiparasitic by the World Health Organization and the US Food and Drug Administration. It is widely used in low- and middle-income countries to treat worm infections. Also used for the treatment of scabies and lice, it is one of the World Health Organization's essential medicines. In addition to its antiparasitic activity, it has been noted to have antiviral and anti-inflammatory properties, leading to an increasing list of therapeutic indications. Ivermectin has exhibited antiviral activity against a wide range of RNA and some DNA viruses, for example, Zika, dengue, yellow fever, and others. Moderate certainty evidence finds that the large reduction in COVID-19 deaths are possible using ivermectin. Using ivermectin early in clinical course may reduce numbers progressing to severe disease. The apparent safety and low cost suggest that ivermectin is likely to have a significant impact on the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic globally. More from an article in Frontiers in Pharmacology. Ivermectin seems to be at least partially effective, given on positivity, peak viral loads dropped by 0.3 to 0.6 log units, and exposure by 8.8 to 22.3%. Okay, fair enough. We can play this game all day. I can find articles and studies that indicate that ivermectin may be effective. You can point to studies that show that the data proving that they are effective is not there, or that the studies have flaws in them. Though there doesn't seem to be any studies that prove ivermectin isn't effective, merely that the findings are inconclusive. Riddle me this though. In the face of a pandemic that has shut nations down, denied basic freedoms to people, ruined lives, effectively destroyed economies, and where governments are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on jabbing people, where are the major studies being financed on government to prove the actual scientific data, to prove it one way or another? At the very least, there is an open possibility that ivermectin is effective. Surely in the greatest health challenge of our time, governments should be investigating it. There are multiple doctors that have used ivermectin, along with therapeutics, that have had success with treating actual real people that have had COVID. Doctors that have had minimal hospitalizations and deaths from using their treatments. People like Dr. Peter McCullough, and the network of hundreds of doctors that have treated tens of thousands of patients. Then there's Dr. Shankara Shetty from South Africa, who has treated over 7,000 patients, avoiding hospitalizations and death, albeit with a different regime than ivermectin. Ivermectin has not been debunked as an effective treatment for COVID. On that point, my mate is wrong, as even his own response notes. In an article written by one of the review team involved in getting an Egyptian study withdrawn, the interesting point raised was that near the end of the article it says that from their analysis, the trials which were run adequately and were the ones which were inconclusive in their findings. An inconclusive finding does not debunk ivermectin. Okay, so I was a little bit disingenuous asking about ivermectin so specifically. I was really hoping my mate would think about the wider question. If nothing else, these studies show that there are treatment options, that there are therapeutics options available, unless you're willing to think that the 95% reduction in cases in Uttar Pradesh was because 5% of the population was vaccinated. So if treatments are available, why do we need vaccines? At least, why do we need vaccine mandates? Maybe we should stop trying to debunk each other and focus on the big picture. The other discussion was around hospitalizations, the assertion being that the chances of ending up in hospital are reduced following the jab. In support of this, I was sent 9 different links, the 10th later from New Zealand. I'm going to ignore the one from New Zealand for two reasons. One, the data set is very small, only 90 people. And two, New Zealand is several months behind the rest of the world for the rollout. One thing that does come through the data is that there does seem to be an initial drop-off in hospitalizations when countries begin their vaccine rollout. I freely admit that. But let's dig deeper into the links that I was provided. The first was based on US data and has the headline, "The unvaccinated drive COVID-19 infections in the US." Wow, pretty scary. This was written by Katharina Buchholz. She's a data journalist for Statista. She's also written articles on climate change and Asia's sinking cities. And she's a contributor to the World Economic Forum. Maybe that's why Katharina chose to show data only between August and September this year. There is other data which shows that the gap was much closer than she portrayed. What the data she uses doesn't show is people admitted to hospital after vaccination for reasons other than COVID. For example, people that have had an adverse reaction, stroke, heart attack, blood clot, or any of the other listed side effects. They don't count in the data. Naturally, it also doesn't count people that die after getting the jab. Fair enough. We're only talking about the efficacy of the jab for COVID, not overall health and mortality. Another link included data from the National Immunisation Management Service in the UK, which showed that out of 40,000 patients with COVID-19 who were admitted to hospital between December 2020 and July 2021, a total of 84% had not been vaccinated. To further illustrate the point, they noted that for the week beginning Monday 16th of August 2021 and the week ending Sunday 12th September, the rate of hospitalizations of over 80s was 50.5 per 100,000 in the fully vaccinated and 143.9 per 100,000 in the unvaccinated, while deaths were 45.5 and 145.4 per 100,000 respectively. Again, pretty damning. But wait, a look at the data from 1 February 21 to 21 June 21 shows a slightly different outcome for Delta. In total, 70 out of the 27,192 vaccinated individuals in the study died, which is a 0.26 mortality rate. Meanwhile, 44 out of the 53,822 unvaccinated people in the paper died, resulting in a 0.08% mortality. You heard that correctly. 0.26% of the vaccinated group died, while 0.08% of the unvaccinated group died. In case you're wondering, 0.26 is higher than 0.08. Again, a study published by the Wall Street Journal showing preliminary findings by Israeli health officials revealed more than half of adults infected in the outbreak of Delta variant in Israel had received the vaccine. About half of adults infected in the outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19 in Israel were fully inoculated with the Pfizer vaccine, Wall Street Journal writes. Again, remembering, of course, you're not vaccinated until 14 days after your second jab. So what does the Times of Israel say? Well, for a start, they don't link to any studies or data sets. A headline from October 8, serious COVID cases hit lowest rate in nearly 2 months. Most are unvaccinated. What I do find really interesting in the article is the apparent decreasing amount of compliance. According to the Health Ministry, 6,174,330 people in Israel received at least one dose, 5,675,635 have had two doses, while 3,706,434 have had three. Bearing in mind that the green pass meant life is pretty awkward for the unjabbed in Israel, and that now you need three shots to get the green pass. So, 8% of the people that got the first jab never got the second. At the time the article was written, only 65% of those that had the second jab had got the third. That number will undoubtedly go up, but even if it got to 92% like the second dose, it means that 957,110 people have dropped out of the vaccination program. Think about that for a minute. Almost, or perhaps at least, 1 million people that are either brought into the government's marketing campaign or were coerced in getting the jab to get their freedoms back would have dropped out of the program. This safe and effective vaccine that is keeping people from dying, keeping people from hospital, Ask yourself why are so many people opting out? They weren't anti-vaxxers. They took at least one shot. What the hell is going on? I think I've talked about the data enough. All of the links sent had similar questions that could be raised. Either specific timeframes selected to tell the right story, definitions of vax versus unvax that are convenient, testing regimes that are, in a word, dodgy, and focus on COVID, not all-cause hospitalizations or death. One of the most telling and despicable factors of this pandemic has been the manipulation of the data to drive the narrative that the government and health officials are seeking. Remember, if you died within 28 days of having a positive PCR test, it was recorded as a COVID death. Shot, car accident, heart attack, cancer, old age, all COVID. Now, if you are jabbed and died within 14 days, it can't have been a jab because you are not jabbed. And many doctors and health officials are refusing to acknowledge any link, even when people have literally dropped dead in the vaccination clinic. To my mate that sent me the links, I accept that the studies and articles you sent through show that based on the data they used, vaccinated people are less likely to end up in hospital and less likely to die. Before you send me any more though, please read them more carefully. Ask, what questions are they not answering? What data have they left out? Why did they select those dates? And perhaps, who authored them and who is paying the bills? For me, the data is not yet clear. There does seem to be an initial benefit, but does that last? Do vaccinated people have a higher risk of hospitalisation over time? Does the benefit outweigh the risk? Gee, if only we had some long-term studies before we mandated it. If you enjoyed the show, please take the time to subscribe and like. If you want to contact me, you can do so at admin@unjabbedcitizen.com. Until next week.